Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's New Year's Day, so 2016 has just begun. And today we're going to do a podcast about a subject that we've been talking about for, well, days and days now, possibly even weeks and possibly years, really, to be honest, which is Nietzsche's phrase, "My biggest danger is disgust at man." And to be honest, over the years, I've discovered that this is also my biggest danger as well. And, you know, I know you, Pete, have often said that you feel this to be true of yourself too. We feel that probably quite a lot of people are suffering from this as well.
Oh, definitely.
So what do you think Nietzsche meant by this statement? Tell us about what he was thinking and how he got there.
You need to have a little bit of an idea of the context to understand what he's going on about. And believe me, it's far-reaching what he's going on about, even though it doesn't seem particularly philosophical or at the outset, you know, you could kind of hear Nietzsche say that and shrug. You think, well, why is he bothered?
Because initially, it doesn't feel like a very important statement.
But you start digging around in that, and you realise, bloody hell, this opens up in all kinds of directions.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Well, the context is that Nietzsche's big thing is life affirmation. He thinks this is what he wants for himself. He wants to be completely life affirmative. He also thinks it's the right thing for people of his type.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, questioning people.
Yeah.
And by life affirmation, it's not a thing that you can give a pat formula to. Nietzsche spent the whole of his active life pondering what exactly it would mean to affirm life fully.
Yeah.
And also, he put a lot of effort into tracking the cultural consequences of its opposite, or its complement, you might say, life negation.
Yeah.
Wanting to disvalue life in various ways, you know. And for Nietzsche, this is a big cultural driver since prehistory. So life affirmation, yeah, I mean, it's not something we can kind of give a pat definition.
And he didn't attempt to do that either.
Well, he came up with various formulations and tests for it. You know, the famous one being the eternal return of the same, which he thought was an existential test of life affirmation. We've talked about this before, didn't we?
Yeah, we have,
that podcast, Socrates with a flute.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of saying, it's embracing life, saying yes to life. And now this is the key bit, in spite of its tragic character.
Yeah.
And he thinks this is what the best of the Greeks came up with, you know, until Socrates Plato ruined it by introducing the idea of transcendental escapes from life itself. You know, this ultimate life negation, it's to disconnect from it and sail away into the beyond, into nirvana. Or into the world of the forms. And obviously, as you know, Nietzsche's deeply critical of this as a cultural move. And he did want, I mean, Nietzsche did think of himself as somebody whose words were going to have an influence in the future. Described himself somewhere in one of his slightly crazier phases as a world historical monster.
Yeah.
That's
pretty accurate, actually.
Yeah, I think he was. He was a world historical monster.
Yeah.
So life affirmation, it's kind of saying yes to life. I mean, one of the ways of formulating this is that at any moment in your life, are you prepared to say, "Thus I willed it. Thus I willed it."
Yeah.
You know, it's like a no regrets scenario.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Thus I willed it. Or amor fati. You know, the love of fate. That you love your fate, you love it. Not you don't just endure it. It's not stoicism. It's not stoic endurance. It's that you positively love it.
Yeah.
Not only to endure it, but to love it.
So I remember we had a long talk about that one the other day, didn't we?
And it's actually it's a tremendously forceful forceful idea. And so, nature's biggest dangers, well, you could affirm life, you could affirm thunderstorms and sudden death and so on.
Morning.
And he could affirm his own rage against the machine and the idiocy of his times. He could affirm that to some extent, but there's something. There was something about humanity which he was having, he was struggling with, and it is actually the kind of stupidity.
Yeah.
If you look at the things that he rails against, I mean, he hated German nationalism.
Yeah.
So why on earth the Nazis thought they could enlist his ideas? I don't know.
It's pretty hard just, to affirm life in the midst of all that.
He was vehemently against just the kind of like beer-fueled idiocy of German nationalism.
Yeah.
And anti-Semitism, again, he detested it, absolutely detested it, because it was just based on irrational hatred, you know, and it is toxic, you know, I mean, he says his biggest danger is disgusting man. It's the toxic feeling that you get when you read the newspapers, you read the gutter press and they're kind of crowing about some bombing raid or something, you know. But also, I mean, in Nietzsche's context, there was he was in this kind of annoyed state with the what he called the free spirits of the day. These were the people who believed themselves to be progressive, believed themselves to be liberated in some sense, you know, and to be the intellectual cream and the artistic cream of the day, and he was kind of disgusted at that as well, because he thought people like that were actually entertaining escapist ideas, and he has a kind of a bit of a snotty, priggish rebellion against that as well. But yeah, his biggest danger as a disgusted man is that this is the one thing it's hard to affirm.
Yeah.
Just how stupid the species to which he belongs is at times. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the this figures in his book about transformation, you might call it, Aldo Sprach Zarathustra.
Yeah.
And Zarathustra goes up the mountain to meditate for 10 years in a cave high up a mountain, and his only companions are an eagle and a snake. These are his animals. And after 10 years of greeting the sun every morning, he actually feels, I mean, he just used the word awake, you know, because he's come awake. He's awake and he's full, he feels over full. He has an abundance of joy and laughter and the urge to dance in high spirits. And he's, yeah. And it occurs to him that it now makes sense for him to go back down the mountain to share some of this bounty, to go and teach in the city, and teach the people. And so he kind of sets out down the mountain after 10 years, and he meets an old hermit in the forest halfway down the mountain, and the hermit says he remembers Zarathustra going up 10 years prior. Now this hermit is a guy who, he's also retreated from the world, but in order to love God. Whereas Zarathustra had gone up the mountain to explore himself. And they have a little humorous conversation. The old man says, look at Zarathustra, he's like a child. He's become like a child again.
Yeah.
Look at Zarathustra, he's thoroughly awake. Anyway, as they part, the old man says, well, I'm going back to my hut, I'm going to do a bit more God-loving. for a bit longer. And Nietzsche thinks to Nietzsche, not Nietzsche, Zarathustra. Perhaps he's a kind of Nietzsche alter ego, but Zarathustra thinks, well, the poor old sod, hasn't he heard? God is dead. Anyway, he carries on to town to deliver his teaching. And people are not that interested, you know. They can't understand him. They don't get it. They don't get what he's on about. And he does actually then go back up the mountain after various adventures. So But he has this thing, you know, being disappointed by disciples.
Yeah.
And it's a similar thing. You find a similar thing in Gurdjieff's story. Now, Gurdjieff travelled for 25 years, driven by questioning.
Yeah.
He admits it. He wanted to know, what is the answer? What is the answer to the, what's the meaning of life? Why am I here, is how he put it. Why am I here? And his condition of doubt was agonising to him.
Right.
Which caused him to travel in search of knowledge for 25 years, all the way over Central Asia, North Africa, right the way to Tibet. Because he did think that there was a teacher somewhere who knew this stuff and knew how to impart it. And the story.
I'm actually quite surprised by Withy saying that, because I would have thought he would have realised the answer to that a lot sooner. But there you go, carry on.
Well, he did go down that line because he thought that there was an ancient wisdom to be rediscovered, and that would satisfy him. He looked backwards, in a sense, and was very interested in ancient manuscripts and archaeological remains and so forth.
Yeah.
And the legend goes that he did contact the Sarmoon Brotherhood, who were able to do this stuff for him, answer his question for him and show him the means of transmission.
Did they answer it to his satisfaction?
Well, the legend says, yeah, you know. And of course, then he came back to teach, because he says, well, it makes no sense. This abundance, this knowledge, doesn't make any sense unless I now pass it on, share it, teach, unless I become a teacher, you know. Which, of course, he duly did, but again, he was disappointed by disciples.
Yeah.
He was disappointed by disciples.
So what was it that disappointed him about the disciples?
They couldn't get it. They couldn't do it. They didn't. I suppose for Gurdjieff, there's a strong emphasis on willpower and stuff in Gurdjieff's methods and approaches and his world picture.
Yeah.
He calls his thing the work. His yoga he called Hatha Yoga.
Yeah.
Which means hurry up yoga.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's a fucking oxymoronic.
Yeah. But do you think that's why? Because, I mean, some of his methods are sort of quite extreme, really, aren't they?
Well, after 25 years trekking across the Gobi Desert and blah, 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 people can turn into quite extreme characters. He was an extreme character.
He was an extreme character.
And he admitted it about himself, that there was a massive polarisation within between his devil, his wolf, his inner wolf, his inner predator, and these kind of saintly urges to help suffering humanity. Now, when Zarathustra comes down the mountain, the old man in the woods asks him, says, well, why are you going down there, man? It's a madhouse. And Zarathustra says, oh, because I love humans, I love human beings. That's his motivation.
Right.
Gurdjieff's the same, he's got this side.
Yeah, maybe he feels he loves them because he hasn't seen them for 10 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Gurdjieff has got this side to his character, you know, the bodhisattva impetus, a very strong bodhisattva impetus, you know, to save the world,
yeah.
You know. And by spreading the knowledge that he's acquired through his own self-explorations, assisted by the Sarmoon Brotherhood and so forth. So he has this strong bodhisattva impulse, but he's got this other impulse, you know, just to be a selfish rascal.
Yeah.
You know.
I identify a lot with that.
And he said, these disciples are so fucking hopeless. If I don't get some kind of sign soon that I'm getting somewhere with all this, I'm just going to indulge my selfishness for the rest of my life. Indulge my egotism and selfishness for the rest of my life, because fuck it. Yeah. They're fucking hopeless.
Yeah.
And they couldn't apply will, as I said, you know, he called it the work. He was a very will-focused person. His analysis of the human condition wasn't the one that goes down so a lot these days, you know, mindfulness, blah, blah, blah. It all boils down to man cannot be, therefore we will teach man to be. Yeah? Mm-hmm. The idea being that being is some kind of like stillness meditation.
Yeah.
In which there's a direct apprehension of the world, supposedly. Deeply problematic, actually, but there you go. But Gurdjieff's tack is quite different. His analysis of the human failing, if you might say, is that man cannot do. Man cannot do. Everything we try to do fucks up. it goes off sideways. And he tried to figure out how man could do, you know, what were the skills. And it's obviously some kind of ability to focus the will, instead of have a fragmented will. Yeah?
Yeah.
Or to bring the fragments of will into some kind of harmony and accord, so that they'd work as one point of doing, you know, one point of action, one. And if somebody has a will like that, then they can do good in the world. Yeah, so there's this big focus on will, and he found people weak-willed. And also his other thing was, his disgust at man, he called it the horror of the situation.
Yeah.
And this occurred to him, I think, after the third time he'd been shot. He was shot three times, you know, yeah. And travelling around.
Very colourful life.
Always ending up in war zones and getting shot and stuff. And I mean, he saw the Russian Revolution, and we saw quite a lot of conflicts. Lived through World War One. Actually lived in Paris during the German occupation of World War Two, so he knew, he was very familiar with that tendency of human beings. And he said, if you read the papers and see how much kind of killing and maiming and horror and cruelty is going down, you cannot but be moved by the horror of the situation.
Yeah.
He says, and for me that means, well, I'm like that. I'm a human being like them. And then upon which realisation, the horror of the situation is magnified in your mind about 50 times. Because you realise that, well, that's you as well.
Yeah.
At least potentially. And he says, out of that comes the desire to do something about it. To engage in the work, to find a teacher, to self-improve. See, he's a cultivator, you know?
Yeah.
He's a cultivator.
What do you mean by a cultivator?
He sees spiritual practice and work as a matter of changing yourself to something better. You know, at least partially. I think he's more subtle than that, but at least partially. Nietzsche also, strangely, even though I'd say that both of these characters, both Nietzsche,
They realise the limitations of that.
And I've got stuff to say about the kind of letting be side. You know, the sensitising of the instrument side of it all. So, yeah, both Nietzsche and Gurdjieff apprehended the horror of the situation and were tempted to give up in their various projects as a result. You know, disgust at man. Disgust at man.
Yeah.
I mean, for Nietzsche it means that he can't affirm, he can't do the thing that his heart's desire wishes to affirm.
So how
did... Because he's actually got to somehow put his arms around that stupidity, you know.
Yeah, how did he manage that?
I think he did realise. He said, having the courage of your no, have the courage of your no, have the courage of your yes. That the being life affirmative doesn't mean to say you don't turn around and say fucking stupid anti-Semites.
Yeah.
Fucking stupid nationalists.
Yeah.
Fucking stupid patriarchs.
Yeah.
You know, he says you can. It's a failure in your realisation of affirmation to think you can't say no to anything, that you can't be disgusted by anything. You can.
Yeah.
But you're not in struggle with that response.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
So.
So it was engaging with the disgust in a different way.
Yeah. It's kind of.
So that it wasn't paralysing, because that's what I find.
Yeah, yeah.
The disgust at man thing I just find really paralysing. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's like it destroys your love. That's what the disgusted man does.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like it's really hard to kind of keep loving the humans when you're just completely disgusted with them.
Yeah.
And that's a horrible feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was engaging with the disgust in a different way, or.
Yeah, he's letting it not become a sickness.
Yeah.
Because what happens to Zarathustra is become sick, you know, and what happened, I think, to Nietzsche himself personally, was this emotional response and this apprehension of human folly did make him ill.
Yeah.
He was very sensitive, you know, and it made him ill.
Do you think this was the reason why he wrote Zarathustra?
It's partly that. I mean, he said that he wrote Zarathustra to give the best account that he could of affirmation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to introduce the ideas of eternal return and the overman and so forth.
But then later on, he added those chapters, didn't he? Well, about being disgusted by the...
The Last Men, yeah. Part four kind of does specifically kind of get into that. Using a different kind of language, perhaps different vocabulary, but he's kind of feeling a bit derailed by the modern free spirits, you know, the higher men.
You know. What does he mean? Who are the higher men?
I think they're the intellectuals of his day. You know, and the artists of his day, who he found too self-congratulatory.
So higher men is like a bit of a piss-take term he has for them.
Yeah. Well, he says, you know, I suppose the thing in Zarathustra is that man is a bridge. Man is a bridge. We're on the way to something better and should be a little bit more careful about congratulating ourselves there with the pinnacle of fucking creation.
Yeah.
Because it's going to go further. And I think that's all that overman means, you know, or ubermensch. It's to give a placeholder for a more life-affirmative future, you know, for a future in which the world culture is life-affirmative and Dionysian.
Yeah.
Rather than life-negating and religious.
Yeah.
Or even if it worships science in a religious fashion, that too would be a disaster.
Yeah.
He wants to see a global Dionysian culture.
Yeah. So Nietzsche's answer to the disgust at man was this very nice phrase that he came up with there, the courage of your no.
And the courage of your yes as well.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, the courage of your refusal. I mean, if we want it like a yoga revolution on planet Earth, all it would actually take is for people of goodwill to refuse to partake in the horrible violent system.
Yeah.
Just to the extent that you can withdraw your energy from it. Doesn't even matter if you can't do all of it.
Yeah.
The whole lot would come down in no time. Yeah. But if kind of yoga people and meditators keep nailing their flag behind nationalist ideologies and religious particularities, there's no hope. Of all that openness and potential that yoga promises across the world to manifest, it won't.
So how about Gurdjieff's answer to the disgust at man, or as he puts it, a horror of the situation? How did he deal with it?
Well, with an extremely kind of zany sense of humour. And I have to say, he was a stubborn bugger and he wouldn't give up.
Yeah.
That's why he wrote his three books, you know, and it must have been tremendous effort to write Beelzebub particularly.
Oh, yeah, tell us about those. Very interesting. And there was a film made as one of them, wasn't
there?
Yeah,
he was a teacher. I mean, Gurdjieff was a teacher and a world historical monster, like Nietzsche, you know. But he'd done it from this kind of Asiatic thing of being on a quest and meeting your teacher, all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And having the techniques and the secrets imparted to one through initiation, this kind of malarkey. And he didn't give up, and he decided he would leave his teaching to the world in a book form. But a book is understood here by Gurdjieff not as just a collection of points of information, but as a device in its own right.
Yeah.
And something the reading of which will engage you in a certain way, just as the Yoga Sutra does. And Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, his first book, kind of 1,000 pages of extremely impenetrable text.
So but you have to read it three times.
And he said, read it three times.
What a bastard.
Yeah. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of forcing you to do the work, and in doing to read the thing, to get the goodies which he's promised are in there. Like a fool, you pursue the goodies. There are goodies, but they're not the goodies that he promises, they're somewhat else. But he has to make that promise to get you to engage with it at all.
Yeah.
when you develop the kind of, well, if you can crack that, you can fucking crack anything nearly, I reckon.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you get this focus of will, which causes this thing man cannot do. So his works were devices as well as just simply being points of information. They work on you, they engage with you, they plant seeds in the brain which germinate.
You were saying you have to read them in order or you go mad or something.
That's right, yeah. Supposed to read Beelzebub's tales first three times and then read Meetings with Remarkable Men, which is quite different from Beelzebub's tales. And it is Gurdjieff's story of his journeying, his 25 years of journeying across Asia in search of knowledge.
Yeah, and that's the one they made a film out of.
They made a film out of it, you can get it on YouTube. It's a rattling good read and a rattling interesting story.
Yeah.
And there's a lot in it as well. And then he wrote, Life is Only Real Then, When I Am, his last book, and it's quite short and quite kind of matter of fact, and it ends in the middle of a sentence. So Gurdjieff may well have died when he was putting that together. But the point here is he didn't give up.
Yeah.
He sought a means and a method, and he sought devices that he could float out into the universe and that would operate even after he died. Again, similar to Nietzsche in this respect. I mean, Nietzsche said, I'm writing for the next 1,000 years, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, grandiose and crazy, yeah, but kind of true as well. In his mind, he's addressing an audience as yet to be born.
Yeah.
Teacher types always do that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I suppose Nietzsche felt he reached the point where he was able to put his arms around it, you know, and to be cheerful in the face of the madness, you know, and to recommend laughter and dance. As did Gurdjieff, recommended laughter and dance, you know.
Yeah.
It's a sense of humour.
Music, isn't he?
Yeah, music, laughter, dance. These are core elements in the work. So.
What about Patanjali? Does he have any thoughts on this subject?
No. I don't think I can kind of see that figuring very largely in there.
Maybe he was lucky and had good disciples.
Well, I think it was a different time.
Yeah.
You get the impression from Patanjali and from the whole tone and thrust that there were plenty of people around who were very, very focused on wanting to sort out their yoga shit, or to answer their question, what the fuck's going on here, who am I, what am I, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And that they were primed and ready for it.
Yeah.
And that the culture supported it at that time to an extent. I mean, I know some people were like rounded up and shot and stuff, or whatever the equivalent was in those days.
Yeah.
You know, there were phases of tolerance.
Asking of self-expression.
Yeah. And there were phases of intolerance. I mean, Patanjali seems to be addressing a very well acclimatised group of disciples, I think.
Yeah.
Who know his language already.
And how about you personally? If one of your students, i.e. maybe me, was going to come up and say, oh, Pete, you know, just, you know, this disgusting man's absolutely killing me. How are you dealing with it personally? And you know, do you have any recommendations for me? What would you say?
Well, it's like all of these things, you can't escape from them and expect any kind of result in that way. So don't escape of the first advice, and you know, to be with it as clearly and openly as you can so you will understand it, and so that that kind of stuck energy, which is what it is, will kind of decrystallise and flow again.
Yeah.
Move back into the flow.
Yeah.
But it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy. And I think Nietzsche again understood that to affirm life, you have to have a lot of energy, especially if you're going to do it, you know, and you don't have your eyes closed as to the nature of the reality around you, and particularly as to human stupidity.
The human stupidity is a real tough one.
It's tough, yeah.
Maybe that's why Nietzsche and his like were writing for people in the future, because he was hoping that they would be less stupid.
Yeah. Well, the culture which kind of informs people's mentality and character structure, we'll have a better one. A less toxic one. I mean, that is battleground, is culture, you know, and the culture of the future. Bearing in mind that, you know, culture is what children are introduced into and at least partly made out of. So, Gurdjieff too, that's his battleground. What seeds can I plant? That will kind of flow down into the future, you know?
Yeah. And with any luck, let's hope that this podcast, although a tiny seed floating amongst the world, may take root somewhere and grow, yeah, possibly into some, yeah, monstrous misunderstanding that destroys the planet, or you know, something that might actually be helpful for a few people.
Well, you just got to love the bastards regardless. Don't mean to say you have to take any shit personally.
Yeah. So affirming life doesn't, yeah, mean that you have to be passively allowing everyone just to slap you and kick you in, yeah, the bollocks and punch you in,
you,
the teeth and trample all over you, walk all over you and use you.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that at all.
Yeah.
You can still affirm life and just fight back like a good 'un.
Yes, over and out.